Welcome to the Science Review. We'll be talking today about issues in science, politics, and the law. Let me introduce my guests first of all. Starting over here, Lawrence Krauss, who is the Foundation Professor of the School of Earth and Space Exploration in the Physics Department, co-director of the Cosmology Initiative, and inaugural director of the Origins Initiative at Arizona State University. He was also one of the founders of the Science Debate 2008 movement. Next to him, Cheryl Kirschenbaum, Duke University marine biologist, has been a congressional fellow working in the Senate on energy, climate, and ocean policy. Also helped found Science Debate 2008, now is blogging, also from Duke University. To my right, Nita Farahani, who is a professor in law and philosophy at Vanderbilt. She researches and writes about the intersection of criminal law, genetics, neuroscience, and philosophy. And to her right, Walter Sinnott Armstrong, who is Professor of Philosophy and the Hardy Professor of Legal Studies at Dartmouth and co-director of the MacArthur Law and Neuroscience Project. None of them appears to have one job. They all do several jobs, which is exactly what we're talking about here, because we're talking about the intersection of science, social policy, interdisciplinary issues. Let me start on this side of the table with a story that I recently read, which struck me as a bit of alarming, but also gets us straight into the issue of where science, the boundaries between science and other disciplines. The New York Times story from a couple of weeks ago, India's novel use of brain scans in courts is debated. And it turns out that a judge has explicitly cited a brain scan as proof that a suspect's brain held experiential knowledge about a crime that only a killer could possess, and ended up sentencing her to life in prison. Stanford University law professor Hank Greeley said that this was interesting but alarming. Nita Farahani, your take on this, or Walter?
So it is alarming, and it's alarming because, first of all, the technology that they use there, which is the brain electrical oscillation signature technology, is brand new technology. So it's technology that really hasn't been tested. The testing of it has been very limited, only in laboratory settings. And it's based on EEG technology, where they attach electrodes to the scalp of an individual and then try to determine whether or not, based on the response levels from the electrical impulses on the scalp, whether the individual has knowledge about a past event that occurred or whether or not it is something that is unfamiliar to the individual. So this person, Ms. Sharma, who was the individual that the New York Times was talking about, the police interrogated her about whether or not she was in fact the murderer. I believe it was her boyfriend that they were interrogating her about. And she was silent the entire time. So they attached these electrodes to her brain and asked her a series of questions, like, is your name Ms. Sharma? Were you, in fact, aware of, or were you at McDonald's the day of the incident? Were you, in fact, the person who committed the crime? And then simply based on the electrical impulses that they obtained through this technology, they determined that she was, in fact, the murderer, and they used that information to convict her. Now, that may seem alarming and seem something like we wouldn't do in this country, and yet we are. So we're using this technology, and it's already being introduced into both criminal cases in this country and more prevalently being used by the military and under development by the military for use in interrogation abroad. So we see it being used and touted a different kind of technology, which is fMRI technology. It's magnetic resonance imaging technology. And that technology is much earlier, even still in development, where it requires a very large magnet. A person is basically put into this magnet, asked a series of questions, and then the developers of this technology claim that they can tell, based on increased cognitive processing that happens through deception, whether you're lying or whether you're telling the truth. And so there's a great deal of excitement in this country that we may have the ultimate lie detector, right? Now, you can imagine that for military uses and for technological uses in the field, this might be quite appealing, right? So for interrogations of individuals in the field, for possible counter-terrorist activity, if we could actually have a portable device, which is what this EEG technology potentially promises, if we could deploy it in the field and then take it out and interrogate individuals, it could be quite promising. The danger is that it really doesn't tell us very much yet. It's very easy to have countermeasures to this technology. And Hank Greeley, who's the person who commented in this particular story, noted in a research study that he did, looking at all of the empirical evidence that to date has been published, that we simply do not know enough yet. So most of the studies have been conducted in laboratories with 20 or some, at most, college students. The stakes have been quite low, where the things they've been asked to lie about are, for example, what card did they hold? What playing card did they hold? Did they, in fact, steal a bracelet or a watch when they were invited to steal a bracelet or a watch? And the stakes that are involved are, if they're able to trick the machine, they'll get $20 or $50, right? We're not talking about stakes that are, you know, a terrorist who potentially will go to Guantanamo Bay and be declared an enemy combatant without any rights, or an individual like Ms. Sharma who'll be put away for life in prison. So it's terrifying technology that is already being deployed far ahead of the science.
Okay, lots of issues there, but perhaps you could elaborate a little.
I think that's the crucial point, is that it's far ahead of its time. You know, science takes a long time to develop. You don't just run a few lab experiments and all of a sudden you've got a device which is going to read everybody's mind and tell you the truth. Scientists recognize that. They know it's going to be a long time before this technology is ready. It's promising. There's potential. We'll have to wait and see. But the courts don't want to wait and see. They want to apply it now to this case because they have to reach a decision this week, not 10 years from now. And so they're jumping on the bandwagon, grabbing what they've got, and it ends up being unreliable, and it's going to hurt a lot of people if we let that happen. So part of the role of the judges in the legal system is to stop this from happening, to not let the evidence in too soon before it's reliable. But the judges often don't know either. After all, many of the judges are not trained neuroscientists. They don't know, you know, an MRI from an EEG. And so they need some help. And scientists then need to get involved with the judges and the court system to make sure that these potentially very valuable technologies don't get abused and lead to more serious problems.
Okay, but you're a co-director of a project now, which is funded by the MacArthur Foundation with a non-trivial amount of money. To start looking at these issues, I mean, how far along is that project in bringing together science and injecting science into the law?
Well, we're right at the beginning. We've only been going for about a year so far. It's taken us a year just to get the lawyers and neuroscientists able to understand each other because they talk such different languages. And we're now starting to design experiments that will test whether certain applications are viable for the uses to which they're put in the courtroom. So you might have, for example, studies that show that frontal lobe function affects certain decision-making abilities. But what's the relevance of that to criminal responsibility? Well, that requires reflection on exactly what those disabilities are for people with frontal lobe deficits, and also whether those deficits are or are not legally relevant. So the two groups have to get together and use both of our expertises in order to draw any reasonable conclusion. And that's going to take a while.
So you've got a background also in genetics, also in biology. I mean, do you have any sense of foreboding here, any sense of alarm that we had a big problem with lie detectors as they were.
Right.
Now, I've heard people talk about this as a kind of a neo-phrenology, that obviously there are good things that one hope will emerge from this kind of technology, but
well, so,
this
I
is
mean,
a woman's entire freedom here.
Right. I mean, I think the lie detection is just the tip of the iceberg, though. So, yes, I think lie detection is, you know, if we look across history and the history of science, right, there has always been the search for the perfect truth-detecting technology, right? And now, if we could actually peer into the brain and see the brain light up and in response to a lie versus a truth, that seems like the ultimate kind of reliable evidence that we could introduce into the criminal courtroom.
It's certainly an improvement on the Inquisition's techniques.
Well, maybe, but maybe not, right? I mean, we don't know enough yet to know whether or not it actually is an improvement on the Inquisition techniques. You know, it may be just as unreliable as the Inquisition techniques and just as likely to produce false positives and false confessions and everything else, right? So it is also likely to be just as insidious, right? So one of the ways this technology could be used and one of the ways in which the applications are pushing forward is trying to develop remote detection technology. So right now, that seems to be science fiction, where you could actually pick up electrical impulses from the brain without actually having to attach anything, right? So right now, this technology requires you actually have an electrode attached to the brain, or several different ones attached to the brain, or a helmet that you're wearing, or a headband that you're wearing, or for fMRI technology, you actually have to lie very still and be in a very large magnetic field to pick up the kinds of information from your brain. But the technology and the research that's being funded is to try to pick up those electrical impulses remotely. So we give off a lot of electrical signals from our body and particularly from our brain. And if you could actually pick up that information without attaching any of that kind of technology, then you could do so surreptitiously, right? And so you could ask a series of questions in an airport, for example. What's in your bag? Did you actually pack it yourself, right? And when you're asking those questions, if I could pick up your electrical impulses, then I might have much greater reliability. Now, assuming that technology is good, maybe that's a good thing. Assuming that technology isn't good and we're simply picking up generalized levels of anxiety because, you know, we all know that it's not that pleasant to go through airports anymore, right? Then what's going to happen? Are we going to start imprisoning people because they're fearful to go through airports and because they're anxious as, you know, they're about to miss their flight and being interrogated by the person at the ticket counter? Or, you know, you have a police officer stop an individual and ask them for their driver's license. You're terrified because, you know, you're late for your appointment, or you're terrified because you actually have a gun that you've stashed under the, you know, front seat beside you. If we can have this remote detection technology, how is it going to be employed? What's the likelihood of respecting civil rights? What's the likelihood of respecting constitutional rights? How do those things interplay with one another? So it's not just this technology that's frightening. It's the host of this technology with all of the other technologies that are under development for decoding brain activity, for remote detection of brain activity, for being able to change brainwave and brain patterns. So some of the technology at the forefront is also to try to see if we can augment cognition and also to change patterns of behavior. Once we understand how the brain works, can we induce cooperation by changing brain waves and by actually applying different electrical impulses to make somebody more cooperative, right? And if you think about the ends of the technology, it's the interaction of all of these technologies, I think, that are really quite frightening.
I think those things are very far off, though. I mean, they can't even get the lie detection to work, you know, when it's right up on your skull. And the remote detection stuff they're talking about is, you know, way off in the future. I think it's important to emphasize that there are real problems that this technology is responding to. You know, there are people who lie in the courtroom. Yep. We found out through DNA that a lot of mistakes are made. We know that our prisons are filled with, you know, more people than ought to be there. And the legal system comes to science and says, how can you help us? You know, how can you find out something about addiction that will help us determine which people ought to go to drug courts and which people ought to go to jail? Because right now we're pretty much guessing. Scientists want to help, but it's going to take a while. The court system has to be patient. The dangers that come are in jumping on the bandwagon too quickly and using things that are unreliable, right. I think, are the main problems that arise now.
But that's part of the problem, right? So as you pointed out, Walter, the legal system doesn't wait, right? So I agree that a lot of this technology is far off from actually being ready for, you know, being used, and that some of it has great potential for the legal system, right? So a lot of the technologies that we're relying on today are very unsophisticated. Eyewitness technology is one of the worst technologies that we have today, right? So false eyewitness accounts are one of the, you know, worst and most frequent ways in which we convict people. Right. And if we actually had reliable accounts that we could use through technology, it would be fantastic. And yet, what happens is this technology gets ahead of the scientific development, and scientists, many of whom are interested in making commercial gain, like no-lie fMRI and or is it no-lie MRI and Cephos, who, you know, have both respectable publications that they provide and also a lot of claims that they're making that are ahead, I think, of the science, you know, appreciate the commercial advantages of having the technology introduced ahead of its reliability and ahead of its readiness for the legal system. And so as soon as there's a technology that is that shows promise, it is deployed in the legal system, and it's deployed in the military context as well. So we have a lot of technology that is farther ahead than we believe it to be, simply because it's being developed through defense purposes rather than being developed for civilian purposes.
I'm going to ask you one question then, and then bring Lawrence and Cheryl into this, because this is obviously a political issue as well and bears on the campaign. But how do we get this information across to the people who need to know it? We actually happen to be in the Salk Institute today. I've been here before when there has been a conference of judges here who are trying to learn, interact with neuroscientists, with other scientists as well, to try and get some information that would aid them in their sentencing. That's obviously one step. Judges need to perhaps be more aware of what's going on and what the... But juries? Obviously consisting of people who may not know any of this stuff at all. Is that good? Is that bad? How much do we need to get out there?
We've got to get a lot out there. The judges know that. They're very eager to find this out. We run an education and outreach program that does 4, 5, 6 weekends a year where judges come in and learn a little neuroscience and talk about the implications, and they're always oversubscribed. One of our members spoke to, I think it was over 500 judges in Texas just a couple of weeks ago. They really want to learn this, and we're going to put together a primer, which will be a small, accessible handbook, a reference book of totally neutral, reliable information that judges can refer to. And that information can be used in the courtroom to keep some of the misleading representations out. In the end, in a particular case, to inform the jury, it's got to be information that the lawyers on the two sides are presenting. And so the judge's job is going to be to stop the misleading representations, to make sure that prejudicial evidence doesn't get through, only probative, not information that's going to sway them too much on arbitrary grounds. But the judges have to know a little bit more about neuroscience to make that process really work. So I think the real fulcrum point here is the judges. If we can get them to understand the issues a bit better, then the whole system will work a lot more smoothly, and that's why we're focusing there. But there are lots of other people to focus on, the prosecutors, because most cases, you know, never get to trial. They're plea bargained. And the legislators, because the judges are enforcing the laws that are passed. So we're starting with the judges, but we recognize there's a long way to go. There are a lot of people to educate on these issues.
And you have said that, just one final thought here, you have said that when you actually approach scientists to supply this evidence, that you've got to... Don't bother me.
Yeah, so, I've said that I think that the responsibility, you know, in part is to educate the lawyers, right? So many attorneys, whether they're judges, whether they're legislators, don't have the legal background, but I think scientists have to get involved, and I think they have to get involved in a much bigger way than simply through the MacArthur Project. They need to get involved in cases. So the example that we had talked about previously was I've approached scientists in past cases where science has been an issue and asked them to get involved in the case in a neutral way, right? So to file an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief that says, here's the state of the science. And they can file such a brief that is neither on behalf of either party, right? So it's truly a friend of the brief court that says, here's what we think the state of the science is. It's not as far as you think it is. And so it is informative in that particular case. And they're so reticent to get involved in those particular cases for fear of especially in the behavioral sciences, for fear of claiming that there's any sort of criminal link between criminal behavior and science. The fear is in part based in the early history of the American eugenics movement and the involvement of scientists in the American eugenics movement, that you see a real resistance by scientists in getting involved in legal cases. And I think that has to be overcome, right? The only way in which these cases are really going to go forward with the best possible information is if scientists are willing to stand up and say, this science isn't ready for this particular case. The state of the science is that it's not ready. It doesn't tell you what you think it does. Or more importantly, here's what it does tell you. Here's how it can effectively be used. Because to Walter's point, some of this technology will get to the point where it gives us reliable information and is much better than what we're using today in the criminal context or in any legal context.
But it needs input from scientists.
But it needs input from scientists to do so.
A lot of time.
Yeah.
So Lawrence, first of all, your reaction to this whole concept. And secondly, this is obviously something that I would have thought that political candidates, political audiences ought to be interested in. I mean,
it's the courts, but it's down the road. I mean, I was going to jump in and ask, I mean, as we talk about fMRI and all these complicated things, polygraphs are still employed in lots of places, and we know they don't work. And so I was going to ask, we already know the science tells us they don't work, but they're still used. And so I was wondering how effective it would really be whether the courts and legislatures would effectively listen to scientists, because they're not listening now about polygraphs.
Well, they are listening about polygraphs. So, polygraphs cannot be compelled in any case. They cannot be used as evidence in any criminal case unless it is requested by the defendant. And even then, most scientific standards, right, so using the standards that prevents science from being introduced in cases, prevents polygraphs from being used. So it is in almost no case in the country can polygraph really be used anymore.
But now, that's in cases. When you get to FBI employing
exactly,
people,
right.
When you get to the police also interrogating suspects in advance to figure out which leads to follow up on and which ones, to follow up on later if this one doesn't go anywhere, a different burden of proof lies there.
Exactly.
Suppose you've got 10 suspects, you've got to figure out which one you're going to follow up on first. Even if it's not terribly reliable, it might be better than just flipping a coin or picking a card.
Well, to try and bring it back probably to the question you asked, Roger, the question, of course, is how can reliable scientific input impact on the legislative process, the courts, and government? And I think, I agree with Nita that scientists have to do a better job of trying to get involved in the process, because right now we're not being very effective in almost any realm of public activity. And I think we've seen over the last 8 years the science become more and more disenfranchised in some sense in terms of public policy making. And it's concerned a lot of scientists. As you know, I've been part of I wrote a letter with 60 other well-known scientists a few years ago to the president asking for reinstatement of scientific integrity in policy making, in the choice of advisory committees, et cetera. And to bring it to the moment, I think it's quite interesting that this is may become an issue in the current election. I'm intrigued by the fact that it hasn't been reported in any of the media, but it's amazing. It's the first time that 61 Nobel laureates in science endorsed a particular candidate because they think it's better for science, better for innovation, and better for the economy. They endorsed Obama, but I haven't seen it in a single media outlet yet. But I think it's a significant fact that and interesting and worth talking about that at this point it appears the scientific community is beginning to come behind a candidate because of their concern about both the past 8 years and the statements that are coming out of the other party.
Now elaborate on that, but also bear in mind that your organization that you helped start there was asking the candidates in the early days to have a debate about science, health, and so on, but basically a science debate. And what we saw them have were two debates, compassion forums.
Well, it's even worse. I mean, it's not just the debates, it's the media. The Boston Globe did a study in 2007 and tried to see how many times global warming was asked, the question was asked of candidates during that year. There were something like 2,769 questions given to presidential candidates, and there were, I think, four questions on global warming, the same number as on UFOs. And so I think the candidates, part of their response, part of the reason they may not have had a debate about these issues, which are really central to almost everything they're going to do, either candidate, whoever's going to become president has to deal with these central issues. But for some reason, I think they feel, perhaps because the media isn't focusing on them, that that they can get away without discussing them. And and that's why we're very excited that, in fact, for the first time, at least we didn't get a debate, but we got the candidates to write substantive answers to 14 major questions, which have actually had an impact since then, because McCain's statements on stem cells and global warming have already had an impact. And so at least these questions are going to begin to be discussed. And it's hard to know. Well, I guess it's what sells in a political campaign. And I think that scientists have to make it clear that these issues are important, because right now it's not properly appreciated beyond the scientific community that this input is going to have a significant effect on whoever is president and on the economy and health of the nation. I mean, the fact that the other story that's been buried is the fact that the continuing resolution for next year is going to cut science like it's been cut the last 4 years, and it's going to dramatically affect the infrastructure at the forefront, which is going to lead to innovation, or would lead to innovation, which is going to impact upon our economy a generation from now.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, because of the budget crisis, there's a continuing resolution that's saying that basically everything that's non-defense related should be funded at a 2008 level, a flat level. Now, in 2008, in fact, there was another continuing resolution and science was funded at a flat level, that basically ended up cutting a number of proposed increases and proposed programs. And in fact, there was a supplementary budget bill that was put in 2008 to help support a bunch of key scientific initiatives. Now, if we fund things at the 2008 level in 2009, that supplement will then go away, and those initiatives that were funded will have to be cut. And that's everything from the extreme areas, from particle physics to right through to engineering and development and energy. And it's a disaster, especially when we look at the fact that many other countries are increasing the percentage of their GDP they're spending on research. Mm-hmm. And there's a long history of the fact that the amount we spend now is going to impact on our economy and the health of our nation, not next year, but a generation from now. And that's the key point, that we can't expect private industry to support research that's going to pay off economically a decade or two decades down the road. They're just not. It's not a business model that works. But the government, I think, is the group that can support that. And it's vitally important that support of scientific research not decline in this country.
Can I ask you, when you say that it's going to pay off several generations from now, it's easy for us to see how military and defense funding of science will pay off, right? We can see it paying off in the military context. We can see it then being translated into civilian uses of that same technology. But what kind of science is it that you think the government should be funding? And what kind of science do you see other countries funding outside of military funding of science that is basic research? And how will that science impact our economy and help our economy and our national economy, right? Now, it's not private industry, not individuals.
Well, there's a good, I mean, the point, there are lots of great examples that you never know where the results are going to come. For example, funding of particle physics, which led to the development now of the Large Hadron Collider that's just starting up, led to, in fact, the development of the World Wide Web. It was created at CERN because thousands of physicists needed to talk to one another in a way that didn't depend upon where they were coming from. That led to basically much of the modern economy. And, you know, if
I thought that was Al Gore, no?
Yeah, well, he played a role. But so you never know. There's so many examples. A transistor, for example. If in the 1940s people had said, we want to develop faster computers, then you would have found these new cogs and wheels and little motors that have been developing. But the transistor changed everything. And so what you have to realize is that the technologies that are going to impact on the future, we don't know what they are.
Right, but those were need-based technologies which evolved, right? So physicists needed to communicate with one another, and so they started developing something which led to an ultimate result.
But they needed to communicate to one another because they were, in fact, working on an area of research which most people would have said at the time, why are you doing that? It has no commercial application. We just want to understand the fundamental structure of matter. curiosity-based driven research has over and over again basically produced the technologies of the future.
Right, but as the economy is collapsing, right now is a particularly good time for us to talk about it, right? So we can see the economy utterly collapsing, and we try to figure out limited resources and where we apply it, right? It's easy to justify applying it toward military purposes. It's easy to justify applying it toward, immediate benefits and even short-term benefits, but applying it toward having the government fund basic research, right? Not private industry funding basic research, not pharmaceutical.
Basically doesn't fund basic research anymore in this country, to first approximate. There used to be large Bell Labs and large groups that had monopolies that could do it. But in fact, I mean, that's the other surprising thing. It's a nonpartisan issue. Both the House, the Senate, and the administration all supported this thing called the American Competes Act, because the National Academy of Sciences said, look, the number of scientists and engineers, the percentage of the GDP, all these things are decreasing. And if we're going to be competitive in the 21st century, we have to start investing not just in the extreme forefront research, but in scientists and engineers and engineering projects. And in fact, it was innovation and the fact that in this case, John McCain was stepping back from his commitment of supporting the America Competes Act. That was one of the things that the Nobel laureates put in their letter supporting Obama, that innovation is going to be vitally important for this country, and we have to support it at all levels. And that's information technology that goes from one end of the spectrum to the other, because you don't know where the results are going to come from. Sure, you have to do short-term investments, and that means investments in lots of parts of the economy that are going to affect the future, like alternative energy, which has been pointed out, is going to be potentially a great opportunity for this country to have economic benefits. And again, appearing partisan, but in fact that was one of the statements in the Nobel letter too, that one of the campaigns has made a much greater commitment to that than the other.
Cheryl, let me bring you in at this point, and then we'll open it up. You're working on a book with Chris Mooney, mm-hmm. Which next year, 2009, is the 50th anniversary of C.P. Snow's Two Cultures book, which also dealt with the notion of science and its place in society, whether there are two cultures. What Lawrence and Nita were just discussing there was, in fact, the whole concept of how do you get a public sufficiently jazzed by science that they're perfectly happy to fund scientists who are off doing apparently nothing, even though it later turns into something.
And we often do a bad job of explaining why we want to do, absolutely.
Right, and a bad job of explaining why you want to do nothing that may turn into something. What's your sense? You're working at in the blogosphere as well. What's your sense of the mood with and also the 2008 debate, people you've been talking to and so on?
Well, I think what it begins with is right now science is not a voting issue. And until science becomes something that's going to cast someone's vote one way or the other, it's not going to get the same kind of attention as we saw with two faith-based debates that took place. So it's both the job of scientists and the job of media to work with scientists to kind of get that out both to a public who's going to receive it and then speak to their policymakers, and also to each other. I mean, scientists don't really share a mission right now. We think we do, but in terms of advancing science, what do we mean? Do we mean going to Capitol Hill and engaging? Do we mean educating our own students and kind of poo-pooing a lot of advocacy initiatives that have taken place? I mean, there's a big stigma for scientists in a lot of cases to get involved in policy decisions because they feel it compromises their nonpartisanship, it might compromise their ability to get grants in the future. So I think we have to first surpass that and make it acceptable, and also teach scientists to adapt to this changing media environment that we've created. I mean, many, many other areas, religion, other interests that are involved in policy have done a really good job of outreach, and science tends to be very static. We do our research the same way. We don't really react to what's going on in the rest of culture, and because of that, we suffer. So we have to get through a lot of hurdles, I think, to make the case to make science centrally important to an election. But we are making our way slowly to do that. We did get answers to Science Debate 2008, albeit written answers.
And that was the first time, by the way, that had been done in any presidential campaign.
What were the questions about it?
Well, there were 14 of them. They ranged from...
Which we can look at on the web,
of course. Yeah, you can look on the web.
ScienceDebate2008.com.
That's right.
But they were about climate change?
Climate change, human health, the environment. I insisted we keep the one on oceans.
And on on even also on national defense, on in some sense on scientific integrity issues.
Did you have a question in there about how it should be paid for and whether it should come through tax dollars?
Yeah, we actually did talk about the how research should be funded and what priorities you should put on it. And it's very enlightening to read the responses to that, which were quite different.
I mean, as you phrase it, when you said how should research be funded, did you make clear that, you know, there are budgetary constraints and that it would mean increased taxes if you're talking about massive funding of primary research?
Well, in fact, you'll see that, in fact, that was discussed in the responses.
And so what were the responses?
Well, the response, as you might imagine, is that John McCain was much more hesitant at this point to make a commitment to supporting research, scientific research.
Well, I mean, to say that he's hesitant to support scientific research at the governmental level, right? So you can support scientific research without putting government funding behind it, right?
What he was saying was that he had always had a commitment, and essentially to the American Competes Act, which was passed.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, what he said was that in fact, he was not willing to make any specific commitments in that regard.
What do you mean by commitments, though? Can we be
specific? Well, you know, the American Competes Act has talked about doubling the infrastructure over the next 7 to 10 years in physical sciences and engineering, doubling the research. In some sense, that to make up for the fact that it was static while the NIH budget doubled over the last 10 years, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, that was a commitment that the House, Senate, and President have all supported. And in fact, it's been in every budget. In every proposed budget, but of course,
but as we run an increased deficit, and as we have concerns about where our priorities are, we have to think about how much we can fund, right?
So, what kind of numbers are we talking about here? Because we're not talking $700 billion.
That's the point. In fact, I was just in Australia, and someone said, you know, how can you support this stuff when you got energy problems, you got global warming problems?
Right.
And the point is, it's not a lot of money on the same.
So, how much is it?
It's less money than we spend in Iraq in 2 weeks.
Right. So, how much is it?
Okay. Well, I mean, what do you want? The budget of the NSF is about $2 billion.
Okay, and so the question is just where that research is spent, right? So
yeah,
I mean, is it spent on things like alternative energy? Is it spent on things that are immediate needs for the economy and immediate needs for for the growth of the country, or is it spent on basic research, right?
Exactly, but is it spent at all? The point is, since it's decreased for the last 5 years, the amount of money we've been spending on all of these things has continued to decrease, they're all suffering. And
there's a big private industry that's developing around alternative energy as well.
There is a private industry developing, but in fact, Lawrence Berkeley Labs is a place where they're spending a huge amount of money trying to think of new ways to more efficiently do solar power, for example, which is going to be crucially important. And that's one of the problems. These are not small problems. For example, you know, take the prize of $300 million for a new battery. I wrote a piece saying if $300 million could solve our energy problems, there wouldn't be problems.
Right.
I mean, these are significant problems that are going to require long-term investments in new materials, new infrastructure, and it's not the type of thing that any one company can do, and it's going to require concerted effort.
Nor that the government alone can do.
Nor, exactly. But we are suffering, and the dollar amounts we're talking about, if it was a matter of doing one versus the other, then I think we'd all talk about it. But we're talking about a pittance compared to the amount we're spending on many other things that many other people would, including myself, would say are not worth spending money on.
But this may be a way to make it a good, a more focal issue in elections, right, is to simply talk about the dollar amounts that you're talking about, right? So if you're interested in making it an election issue, one way to do so is to talk about the dollar amounts that are involved and to get people motivated, because money motivates people in elections in a way that
simply... But science is an easy target. I mean, the point candidates have learned over and over again that you can cut science basically... without response.
Right, but it
you
need
can't
not
cut
be.
The military budget.
You know, I think it's important. Sometimes cutting science actually gains people on your side,
of
because
course.
There are some people who think that science is in conflict with religion and they want to hold on to their original religious views.
Right.
They think that the more you fund science, the more advances, that's actually supporting the enemy in the views of some people. I'm not saying that's the majority out there, but there are certainly people out there who hold that because of conflicts, you know, with regard to evolution, with regard to the origin of the universe, with regard to the methodology of approaching questions.
Well, we're all coming back to what Roger was talking about. This, a law, and Nita too, and Cheryl, the fact that scientists have to do a better, far better job of indicating the relationship of science and society in an effective way.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of, you know, we can blame the media, we can blame government, but the scientific community has not done a very effective job.
But you
and
don't need
we're recognizing it.
You don't need to argue science for science's sake. I mean, obviously, to me, that's something that resonates. But all you need to do is, if you don't want to drill offshore for oil, you don't say, we can't do this because it's bad for the environment. I mean, that's only going to pull in a few people. But when you start talking about the socioeconomics involved in a decision like that, the fact that, for example, in Florida, it's based on a it's a tourism-based economy, and if tar starts rolling up on beaches, they're going to lose a lot of revenue to a state where that's extremely important. All of a sudden, to a policymaker, that might make a big difference.
Right.
So it's making these connections, and there are so many connections far beyond energy, but energy can be that grasping point for all of us to start right now. Energy can be the new Sputnik, or start a movement like Sputnik did, and hopefully energize the country to really support these initiatives. But we need to do better than we're doing now, because right now so many people don't even know if global warming's decided upon, whether it's occurring, and there really isn't even a debate about that anymore. So until we do better, we can't expect better.
Right. Well, I mean, I agree. So, Cheryl, you spent some time on the Hill, right? And I think that helps frame this. So my point is that scientists have to get more involved, but it isn't just in saying things like science for science sake, that science, you know. So I, as somebody with a science background, I loved science simply for discovering more about, you know, our world around us. That doesn't really make it into much of a voting issue, right? But if you can actually show that it has an economic impact, that it's something that is likely to, you know, affect tourism in Florida, and if you can frame it in ways that voters care about, it's more likely to become an issue that's on the table.
The interesting thing is it already has been framed that way. It's already convinced the Congress and the President. That's what's kind of scary. I mean, the National Academy of Science... The America Competes Act was passed by an overwhelming majority, and the National Academy study, Rising Above the Gathering Storm, was quite definitive in demonstrating the economic impact of science and the danger, particularly, and this I think really plays well in the United States, is the competitiveness danger, the fact that our competitors are spending progressively more of their GDP on research and we're spending progressively less. All of that has been quite convincing, and so everyone was convinced, but nothing's happened. So that's the interesting question, and you're right, probably in order for something to happen, you have to convince voters, but it's going to be very difficult. I think it's naive to suggest that it'd be easy to do in times where apparently war and terrorism and a desperately failing economy are huge issues. It's hard to talk about these sort of ancillary benefits of science in a way which can compete with people's fears of terrorism.
Well, I think that's a big mistake also, just to say, well, the reason that we're funding science is so we can keep tar off the beaches. I mean, that's really going to distort the whole thing towards a certain type of science, towards certain areas of science. I don't think the American people are always going to say, well, we're going to demand an immediate payoff for our dollars. I mean, we went to the moon, and that wasn't going to give us any payoff, or it wasn't at all clear that it was. There are lots of basic science issues that people are interested in. It's part of selling that, and I don't think you should necessarily sell it by its immediate economic gains.
Oh, you better
gains.
Not.
You better not.
And I've said that. You can't support anything. And one of the big problems, we had a big physics collider in the United States called the Superconducting Super Collider. We tried to sell it by the ancillary benefits.
Yeah.
If you don't honestly say why you're doing what you're doing, and I feel that way about the space program too. It's a huge, we sell it for complete. We pretend that the manned space program affects science, and it doesn't at all. All of the science that NASA's done in unmanned space.
Let me try and draw a couple of things together there and come back to you. There was you mentioned the Gathering Storm. This was a report put out by the National Academies of Science. The chairman of that committee that produced it was Norman Augustine. Norman Augustine was a retired chairman and chief executive officer of Lockheed Martin.
He's on the steering committee of Science Debate 2008.
And had an editorial in the American Association of the Advancement of Sciences weekly science magazine, Science, which is titled Silence, which is referring to the fact that there's not much going on. The Gathering Storm said, basically, we need innovation for competition. And innovation's a kind of odd thing. It's we're saying, just go into a lab and do some research, and we don't actually know. Because as soon as you say, innovate what, then you've specified a program, and you don't know what you're going to get. I think research, even Einstein said the whole point about research is you don't know what you're going to find out. So we have this report, we have a Congress that needs to be energized to support all this sort of stuff, and as Norm says in this last paragraph, of the 535 members of the U.S. Congress, only 8 list themselves as engineers or scientists. of the 9 senior leaders in China, 8 hold such degrees. How can America's political leaders be expected to make sound policy decisions in a world of increasingly complex science and technology if the most qualified individuals in those fields remain absent from the field of play? So that's point one, which ties together with your statement that everybody now agrees that global warming is a fact. I don't think everybody does. It's still a debate. It's still out there. And in fact, in a recent issue of Newsweek, Sam Harris was complaining about John McCain's choice of a running mate on the basis of her lack of knowledge about certain issues, and raised the issue of, defended the issue of elitism. He was being accused of being elitist, saying that she was, just because she was an ordinary person like other Americans, that that was not enough to run for office. And he made the claim that why is it that in public office, public issues, that we're perfectly happy to accept that argument, whereas we insist on sending elite athletes to the Olympics, you know, elite other people to other places and so on, elite soldiers to war. So on the one hand, we have a lack of informed knowledge about science in the places where it could do some good. And on the other hand, we have people saying, well, you don't really need this elaborate knowledge about science. We just want ordinary people. There's a conflict there.
Well, yeah,
how do we resolve this?
There's a cultural disconnect, more than Europe, between scientists and, I mean, it's really interesting. If you go to Europe, you see that being a scientific or scientist or academic is not that distinct from the rest of the culture as much as it is here. There has been traditionally in this country much more of a cultural disconnect, and our political leaders, but also our intellectual leaders. It's always bothered me that the people we call intellectuals often proudly proclaim their scientific illiteracy. And so it's not just the kids we're not educating in schools and we're not doing a good job of educating kids in schools, but even the smart kids, the kids who are energized, they look at the role models and they see many people who function very well proudly proclaiming their scientific literacy. And so we really have to do, you know, there is a huge problem of connecting science and culture and with that kind of respect. There are the what Norm said about Congress is a real problem, and it's not just not just China. The president of Germany is a physicist, for example, and it doesn't seem so unusual. It's hard to know. There's so many factors going into this marginalization of science from the media beyond that it's going to take a lot of work in a lot of different places, and you just have to keep plugging away. It's going to be a long slog, though.
I'm not sure that we really need more politicians who are physicists, though. Because for one thing, if somebody's a politician, they're going to have to know how to balance budgets, how to write laws. They need to know an awful lot of other things. But, you know, maybe they were a physicist in the old days, but by the time they get up here, they're not up to date on their physics anyway.
Well, they're not going to be either.
What I want to see is more advisors who are up to date on the science and who these people are going to listen to. That, it seems to me, is the way into this problem, to get every politician to recognize that they need scientific advisors from a number of fields that they're actually going to respect and listen to and pay attention to. You can't expect somebody who's in the Senate. They spend over half their time just raising money. They can't keep up with the science journals, so they need other people to do that for them.
Well, although it's the problem is, you're absolutely right, and that's one of the reasons that, you know, that people are excited that Obama has a huge scientific advisory board. But right. But beyond that, there's a problem. It's not, you don't want people to be necessarily physicists. The question is, are they scientifically literate? I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal last year that said, you know, how the president is to some extent an educator in chief. They're trying to push people along in a certain agenda. And unless you convince the public, it's very difficult to do. If a president is uncomfortable with scientific issues, is not literate at some level,
yes,
then how can you expect them to do that? And it amazes me, we wouldn't expect our president to be ignorant of the existence of the Holocaust, okay? But we can consider electing candidates who are completely scientifically literate, and that means they're not comfortable. They're never going to be comfortable leading on those issues, regardless of the advice that comes from them. And the key thing we really want from a president is someone who can distinguish good advice from bad advice.
Yes. Literate,
and that requires some level of literacy.
And curious also, when a scientific issue bears on it, that they'll actually bother to find out what the opinion is in the scientific community.
Well, look, a lot of this has to do with organization. And we have a case right now where we have so many agencies, institutions, universities, who all want to get their own voice into informing Congress, who are all doing individual reports on the same issues, briefing offices one after another on the same broad policy but with different recommendations, preparing all these white papers to deliver to the incoming administration. And that doesn't send a clear message about what needs to happen, about who should be the scientific advisor, about what the next good policy should be. So until we start doing that, until we think about doing things like starting a science PAC, a science political action committee, which has been done in small models like Ocean Champions, there's one called Ocean's Champions, it's been very effective at getting certain members elected. Until we start organizing ourselves internally, I don't see why we should expect that they're going to do it on their own.
Walter, you were saying earlier that in your view, you are less concerned about Governor Palin's views on evolution than her dean macroeconomics. So you take a more pragmatic view on this.
Yes, I mean, if she has a strange view on evolution, which she does, that will inspire other people to take that same view and will lead to bad policies like large numbers of faith-based initiatives and bad educational initiatives and so on, then that's going to be a big problem. But if she happens to hold that view and it doesn't affect the other policies, then it's not really going to make any difference to what she, to the decision she makes. But if she doesn't understand economics and she tries to deal with the crisis that's going on now and gets in a room with advisors and they start talking about different possible moves and she has to choose among them and doesn't have the slightest idea what's going on, then I'm really worried. And, you know, what I heard, you know, I would have to check the documentation, but I heard she didn't do too well in macroeconomics in college. And these kinds of, those types of failures to understand the advisors are going to create serious difficulties in the realistic discussions that people are going to have with the cabinet. Whereas I doubt the cabinet's going to be talking about evolution very
often. But you know, they're not disconnected. We put in the science debate questions, we didn't put it up front, but it was sort of in there on the side. We asked the candidates, in making decisions, how would you rate empirical evidence versus your a priori beliefs. And so we've seen the disasters that have happened over the last 8 years of people who are willing to decide in advance what's right without
absolutely.
And so I think it's important to ask whether a candidate who, for example, believed that dinosaurs and humans walked at the earth at the same time, based on an a priori belief that clearly is contradicted by all the evidence we have about nature, whether that kind of mentality is going to play into their decision making in other issues. And I think it's hard to imagine they'd be that disconnected. So
I completely agree with that.
I agree. Evolution itself may not be an important issue, but the question is, on what basis do people make decisions? And what we really, and in fact, that's the thing we probably do too poorly as scientists. Is it not so much the facts that we care about people knowing? It's the importance of basing your decisions on empirical evidence and not picking and choosing that empirical evidence, but looking at all the evidence, the kind of thing that makes the scientific method work and makes science works, and that so many people don't understand. And I think that's the thing we really want public policy to be based on. We don't care whether they're experts on one thing or another.
But how do you convey the information? Your co-author, Chris Mone, worked with a colleague. Matthew Nisbet, and they wrote a paper in Science in which they suggested that scientists should use the same techniques as successful communicators in other areas. That, in fact, they should strip away some of the excessive foliage from their arguments and present their arguments in a very clear, focused, end-directed way. And they call that framing. There were, in fact, lots of responses in the magazine basically saying, this is spin. You're doing spin. I mean, how come you're turning scientists into politicians? So,
well, you and I have had this discussion before, in fact, but I think the point is that you what you have to do is get people, if you're going to get people interested enough to learn more, you're never in a short article in a newspaper or on a TV program going to have a college course in any subject. What you're going to do, hopefully, is motivate people enough to understand what the questions are and to actually then read more carefully or go to the web or whatever. And so spin is for better or worse, important. You've got to get people excited, and you've got to get people interested enough to want to know why what you're talking about is important, and too many people just don't realize that most scientists, just because they're excited about what they're doing, just assume everyone's excited about what they're interested in, and that's just will get you nowhere. You have to convince people why they should be interested in what you're interested in.
I'd be careful, though. I don't think that framing and spin are the same thing. Right. But when you're talking about a huge amount of science information and needing to get your talking points out, you have to focus on what you're a few bullet points, what it is, why it matters, and how it relates to the person who's reading it. And if you can get that across in a very simple but honest way, you're doing a service to science, because the full report probably isn't going to get read very widely, especially if it appears in a journal that very few people have access to. So I wouldn't call it spin, but I think it's careful framing of issues in a way that's going to either make people want to know more or make them think about their decisions when it comes to voting or when it comes to other.
And okay, scientists have to stop criticizing other scientists who simplify the issue for that purpose. Because I've heard a lot of scientists say, oh, this junior person, you can't trust them. Look at what they said in this article. I mean, there needed to be 10 qualifications. Of course, that person knew the qualifications had to be there. I've heard people say, well, Carl Sagan wasn't all that great. Look at what he did on the show. It wasn't all that precise. Come on. He knows what he's doing at this time for this audience, and that doesn't mean he doesn't recognize that the 10
Although
qualifications...
Although I think scientists are beginning... I mean, I'm someone who spends a lot of my life popularizing science, and I know that there are some negatives that come from that, but I've, on the whole, found that the scientific community has certainly begun to appreciate more the need to communicate what we're doing.
That's great. It's just got to move more.
Right.
Well, there's always going to be that kind of, but I think there is growing support of the need to actually communicate.
I hope so, because I do have many colleagues who it's been frowned upon when they've tried to engage with media, give interviews. They've been told if they want to advance and get tenure quickly, to sort of bow out of a lot of these opportunities. So I hope we get there soon.
Let me interject something here. I'm having trouble following the logic here. If one of the reasons that I heard many times about why the candidates wouldn't have a science debate is it was a no-win situation, the science is too complicated, as soon as they're up there, without advisors around them, trying to answer questions about science, they're going to look stupid. But on the other hand, if you're saying that the best way to get the science across is to, in fact, engage in this trimmed-down version of framing and so on, then couldn't they have been given framed position papers and therefore at least have been literate at that level of information?
Oh, yeah. And I think we made a big point of saying, look, this isn't going to be a science quiz. We're not going to ask you the seventh digit of pi. It's not. In fact, we'll even give you the questions in advance.
But how many scientists how many politicians do you think want to get out ahead of a policy issue?
Exactly.
And actually state what their position is? So do you think in advance of actually having to vote on stem cells that the politicians would want to say, this is what our position is going to be down to the nth degree? None of them actually want to state a specific policy position until they have to state a specific policy position on any scientific issue.
And it's going to be
a nuanced one, right? And so they want to be able to reserve the right to have it be as nuanced as possible in response to public opinion polls and have it be something that, is in response to the time that they have to actually craft that policy.
Yeah, in fact, there was a somewhat subtle subtext here. Part of the reason for suggesting, that we'd give the questions in advance to people was to do just what you were saying. Well, not just to pin them down, but to try and suggest that if they just commented on any of them,
right,
then they would, by their comments, raise this as an issue in the public's perception. So that just getting them to even comment on this would suddenly raise it and make it more of an issue. Because right now, the real reason, there are two reasons I don't think they want to debate. One was the fear of looking like an idiot on a scientific question. The other one was, why, when it's not going to move the voters on this particular issue?
Well, but it would move the voters, right? That's a problem.
I think you're totally forgetting a third one. I mean, there are religious people out there. They think that they're going to ask questions that's going to alienate those voters.
Actually, we thought about that very carefully. We tried to make certain that the kind of issues that we were going to discuss were ones that didn't
but every
really
scientific
hit on
issue
if I'm
actually
a politician,
has,
I don't
for,
trust
for
you
many
to
of the voters, every scientific issue has some religious component to it.
Yeah.
So there isn't a scientific question that you could ask a politician that they wouldn't fear would have spin.
Well, the question
that
was,
would eventually
for example,
end up
innovation
being,
and economic vitality. It's not clear to me that that, I mean,
right.
In fact,
what kind
is
of
a religious
what kind of innovation is it going to be based on, you know, alternative energy? And if it's on alternative energy, is that because you believe global warming is happening? And if you believe global warming is happening, is that because you believe it's human made, or, you know, or something
innovation,
else?
Right? So, I mean, like using embryonic stem cells? Is that what you're
talking
about?
Or adult stem cells? I mean, what is it that you're talking about?
It's clear to me that whenever scientists are planning anything, they should have some lawyers around to keep them honest.
Yeah. Well, I think what you were saying before in terms of why should they rise to the challenge to address this, well, that's a challenge to us to make it the case where they have to. We shouldn't accept no for an answer as a public who cares about our future. If they don't want to hear the term science, I hope everyone cares about their families and the health of their families. Those are issues that speak to people across faiths, across the board, shouldn't matter, but we haven't communicated enough why politicians should be allowed to.
I agree. But you got to communicate to the public first, because if the public demands that the politicians appear, they will appear.
And that part of the reason is to try, educate the public. These are important issues. But I don't quite buy your saying. I mean, the politicians are happy to talk about gay marriage or what defines
because they've
marriage.
Become voting issues.
Well, exactly. But they know it's going to strongly elicit a religious response because they think it's a voting issue.
Right, but it has to be a voting issue first.
If they are convinced that these scientific issues become voting issues, then they won't worry about the religious backlash because they'll try
and win
votes. But
you're putting the cart before the horse, right? You need to make it a voting issue that people care about, just like Walter said. And once there's a demand from the public to know what the position is, they'll tell you.
That's why it's going to continue past this election. Mm-hmm. I don't think there are many of us who were not who felt that it was unlikely there would be a science debate. But we felt by at least getting the candidates for the first time to write public statements on science issues, it would serve to help educate the public that these issues are actually worth discussing. And eventually, it's a chicken and egg thing, but eventually, if the politicians talk about it, the public are wondering why they are. If the public gets interested, the politician is going to talk more about it. And so this is going to be a long haul, and we want to build on this in congressional elections and beyond, because it's going to take a while before scientific issues become voting issues.
Right.
Yeah. What worries me, though, is that if I went around an institution like this or across the street to UCSD and asked people if they knew about science debate 2008, it's somewhat limited.
Sure.
And yet, if you look at the number of organizations in this country and the number of individuals, the Nobel laureates, the heads of institutions,
and business people, and legislators.
It's a who's who of this nation.
It's
surprising. So the fact that there isn't one is almost an extraordinary slap in the face.
Well, the mainstream media chose to ignore it, and as Chris often points out, it's one reason is that science reporters don't feel, well, the science reporters that are still out there aren't able to provide pieces in the political sections of newspapers and magazines and things like that. The policy people don't think it draws enough interest to put it in their parts of stories. But we are getting there. I mean, it's not like these issues are so far. It's not that we have to wait a very long time for these to become important issues. With energy, for example, everyone's just spent ridiculous amounts per gallon to fill their car up to travel anywhere throughout the summer. So we are thinking about how this affects our wallet. We need alternative energy. It might decrease the price to drive to your neighbor's house or to drive down the block. So it's important to people to get there, and it's growing in visibility.
But the point is that there are institutional factors,
and that's a key point. I mean, you're absolutely right. It is a slap in the face. It should be viewed as a slap in the face because the organizations that signed on represent something like, 40 million Americans or something like that? It's just amazing. But the fact is that there are lots of institutional barriers, and the one of the ones that Cheryl mentioned is really important, when one talks about mainstream media, and I hate to use that term, but when one talks about the major papers, we got interest from various reporters, but to get that on the political pages, because the editors, heaven forbid, are still not aware that there's a relationship between science and public policy, and they would say no. You know, report on science, don't report on politics, and so there's a lot of institutional barriers in the media, in particular in this country, that don't understand that. It's an educational process, and maybe we should have. Maybe we should have workshops for editors.
Did you try the cable channels that are devoted to science to see whether they would cover this debate?
Well, I mean, we tried everywhere, and I did interviews on various cable channels, but we actually had TV stations. PBS was willing to sponsor the debate to actually air it. We had at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia during the Pennsylvania primary was willing to host a debate with TV stations. I mean, it had all the infrastructure that any national debate would have. And the 2 days before, the candidates decided instead to do a faith-based forum, and I think it was a political decision. They wanted to reach more voters. And,
but at least they got close. Maybe next time it'll be one day, and then they'll finally show up.
We got closer than I ever imagined we would, and I never imagined the response. Good. So I think it's a good beginning, but it's going to take a while.
And it's also important to point out, we started late in the game. I mean, this began November of 2007. So we're going to be working at it, we're going to continue, and we're going to be better prepared for not just future presidential races, but Senate races, state, other, throughout.
Great. Yeah, it has to be something that becomes part of the routine, and it'll take a while.
Mm-hmm. Science has to be. And if you'd gone to the cable stations, you'd have probably got 2 minutes, which would be about 57 minutes less than you just got here today. but thank you for that conversation, Walter.
Thank you.
And Lawrence and Cheryl and Nita. And we'll be back with another Science Review.